Is the Chicken Big Mac still a Big Mac? It's got two chicken patties, the pickles, the lettuce, ooh, the cheese, the sesame seed bun, and it's got the sauce. It's not a Big Mac. Get it while you can. And participate in McDonald's for a limited time.
Everybody, welcome to our podcast. I'm Anwen.
And I'm Penny.
And this is the Cast of the Rings, Episode 3.
This episode, we're covering The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, Season 1, Episode 2, Adrift.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. Episode 2, it really started to kick in. What did you think overall?
Well, first off, I was so excited to be able to watch it on the regular TV and not my tiny laptop screen. The details were so much more visible. It's even more beautiful than I thought it was when I was watching it on my laptop. I really enjoyed the episode, except the Galadriel plot this episode, I was like, snooze. But I loved all the Elrond parts. And of course, Nori is so lovable. Those parts were wonderful. How about you?
Absolutely. I had the exact same feeling. So as we were sent these episodes by Amazon ahead of time, we did get the chance to see them. But like you say, it was on our laptops and it was quite difficult to see a lot of the detail. So I really did notice that watching it on the TV. I had already seen both episodes at least twice. And so getting to see these more details was fantastic. And again, it was like that third viewing of just letting it wash over you and pick up all the little bits and pieces. So yeah, I can't wait to get into it with you. Just to let everybody know that this is a spoiler-filled podcast for episode 2 of The Rings of Power. And we've decided this time we are going to have a little section later on in the podcast where we're going to describe and discuss things that might be a bit spoilery from the books, things that we might speculate or might be based on some background about characters and upcoming plots. So we'll try not to get too much into that apart from describing a little bit of history and things in the main section of the podcast. But later on, we're going to have a section and we'll give you a warning when that starts about things that might happen later on that might be a bit more spoilery.
Wonderful. Where do you want to start?
Well, we can get straight into our points. I just did want to say first, for everybody who's listening to us, you can either listen to us through podcastica.com or a couple of different ways on your podcast feed. So our episodes are going to appear on the House Podcastica feed, along with all of the other podcasts that are released by House Podcastica. But also, if you just want one feed with just the Cast of the Rings, you can search for that in your podcast app as well and then just listen purely to us, you know, because we're so amazing.
Yeah, we are. It's also really fun that now the episodes have dropped and we're hearing from our friends how much they're enjoying the show, which is great.
It is fantastic. It was so hard to not talk about it with everybody while we had already seen them, but we're super excited that it's been released to the world and there's so many comments out there. I might touch on a little bit later in news as well, but it's awesome to be caught up with everybody and be watching together.
Yeah.
So do you want to go ahead and give us your first point, Penny?
Sure. My first point is about racism. Unlike our, you know, standard Earth racism, the racism in Middle Earth is between actual different races, right? The elves and dwarves and hobbits and humans are biologically DNA different. They have different capabilities. They have different lifespans. You know, human to human, the use of the word race is kind of a misnomer because we're all human, which is the same race. We just have different ethnicities. The racism that happens in Middle Earth is, it seems to be all the different races have issues with the others, especially elves and humans. and apparently elves and dwarves. Nobody really trusts the elves. They think the elves think they're better than everyone else. They think that the elves are just for the elves, that they're, you know, like I said last time, an occupying army. They're basically colonizers of Middle-earth. People don't seem to like them very much or care for them. And the fact that they defeated Morgoth is so long ago that nobody really remembers it or cares about it that much. They just think the elves are, you know, telling them what to do and nosing into their business. And we saw this in the shipwreck section where the humans were super suspicious of Galadriel, even thinking that she led the sea serpent to them, maybe thinking she was in league with it somehow. I think people in this world don't 100% know what powers and abilities elves might have, and so they're prone to fantastical thinking about them. We also saw it, you know, with Durin and Elrond. When Durin was angry at Elrond, he reverted to calling him elf, and he said elves are for the elves, and, you know, other sort of stereotypes about the elven race. I do think that the elves have a major blind spot because of their extremely long lifespans. The truth is that humans who live to be, I don't know, in this world, maybe 75, 80 years old, if they're lucky, they change from generation to generation, pretty dramatically, at least in our world. And the elves don't, right? They remain. They have a fairly large chunk of their population has been alive this whole time, and they're the same people they've always been. So they don't have an understanding of how much humans are capable of change. It's a major theme of Tolkien's work. The Lord of the Rings books were very much about, you know, the many races need to unite to fight this foe. And I assume that that's the point of view of this show as well. I just think it's interesting to sort of think about it in comparison to our own world. And how do you reconcile after a war? Our world bungled it after World War I, which led directly to World War II. The USA messed up after the Civil War. We don't really know how to do this as a culture. And, you know, the elves didn't do everything right either. If they had, the humans wouldn't hate them so much and prefer, you know, being attacked by orcs to asking them for help. I think the most interesting one is that the hobbits, their take on the other races is just pure avoidance. It's like, we hide from them. We don't want them to even know we're here. They don't trust them, and they mostly just want to be left alone.
Yeah, I absolutely love this point, Penny, and it's come up, I think, kind of in show, and also that I've seen a lot of comments outside the show, people talking about it. And I agree with you about the theme that runs through all of Tolkien's works is different peoples uniting against an evil. And, you know, Tolkien himself served in the British Army during World War One. And I think he even wrote about it later, about his experience and about why sort of the one of the reasons, I guess, behind the themes of his writings. And I think this show has really embraced that in terms of not only talking about the differences between the races, but also just exploring, I guess, some of that history that's, you know, between that animosity between elves and humans and elves and dwarves as well. I absolutely love your point about the elves just being quite removed and not really getting, and that's really obvious when we see Elrond not even thinking 20 years was just a blink of an eye for him. And then for Durin, it was heartbreaking to have not seen his friend for that time. So there's just huge differences between these species, I guess, there are in terms of time, how long they live, how they see the world. And, you know, remembering that the elves came to Middle-earth to help save or help assist the humans and the other races that are there. But it's been so long that the humans that live there And as you say, many, many generations of these humans have probably forgotten the main reason why they're there, and they just feel like they're kind of under the thumb of the elves. And I think for me, watching the third time, I really got more of a sense of that from the villagers in the Southlands, that they are really just were watched over by the elves. It wasn't that they were there to protect them. The elves were just there to kind of, you know, prevent an uprising. It just seemed more obvious to me the third time, maybe because I wasn't so absorbed in just the visuals and learning each new character. And you really definitely get that feeling from them that that they're there because they think that humans are full of blood from their ancestors. Their ancestors supported Morgoth, and therefore they're going to uprise one day.
Yeah, last episode, the Watchwarden even says humans supported Morgoth and it's in their blood.
Yeah, like it's assumed. And that's the ultimate kind of racism, isn't it, really? Like, this is what your people do, so therefore all your people will do it. So it's pretty horrific to see. And yeah, I liked the use of elf as a almost derogatory. You know, they don't want to learn their name. So Halbrand does it later on with Galadriel. And then, you know, even though they've been very, very good friends, Durin and Elrond have their conversation and he just calls them elf. It's like an insult almost, isn't it? Like, you don't want to use their name. You just sort of say elf. And he says it in quite a derogatory tone as well.
Yeah. He was definitely trying to hurt Elrond's feelings with it. That was intentional.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then the other thing, I guess, like I was saying about the real world side of that, is that I have seen quite a lot on the internet, a lot of people throwing their toys because they're a bit upset about some people with brown skin in Middle Earth, which I just think is kind of ridiculous. You know, there's magic rings and there's dragons and there's many different magical species, and you're worried about some people having slightly brown skin is kind of a bit laughable to me. And even Tolkien, you know, talked about the Half-Wits being browner of skin, depending on your viewpoint. You know, it's kind of, I think it's a bit silly, and I think it's an interpretation, and I think it's awesome to see a rich tapestry of lots of different people on screen.
I couldn't agree with you more. There's similar arguments going on right now about House of the Dragon. People are very frustrated and upset that there are black Targaryens, I guess. But I don't see a problem with it.
No, I think it's fantastic, and people need to chillax. All right. Was there anything more on that theme of racism from you, Penny?
I'm sure there will be in the future, but not for now.
Fantastic. All right, so the first thing I want to talk about, which is a whole new world for us to look at in this episode, is the dwarves and the might of Khazad Dûm. So we learn here about the friendship between Elrond and Durin. And at first, Elrond turns up expecting this royal welcome, but he's shunned by Durin. And when he's turned away, he invokes the right of Sighin Tarrag, which I thought was very fantastic kind of expression from both of them, and I had to watch with the subtitles on to see what that word was and try and make sure that I could say it properly as well. It sounded a little bit Klingon to me as well, the way the dwarves say it, just saying.
It has that
some fandoms.
Yeah. that harsh sound to it.
Yeah. And this is the dwarven test of endurance. And when you hear Durin introducing this test, he says it's from Ole, and Ole was Valar, and he was a really great smith. He was the one that created the two lamps of Valinor. So this is obviously an ancient ritual that the dwarves have to see who's top dwarf. And Elrond knows that's his way into the door. And of course, we see that hilarious sequence with them trying to both break the rocks, and Elrond eventually gives up, yields, and he asks to be escorted out, and he finds that Durin is super grumpy because Elrond didn't visit him for 20 years. And like we said earlier, it's a blink of an eye for elves, but it's a lot longer for dwarves, so he's really hurt by that. So I thought them walking through Khazad Dûm was so amazing. We get to see the kind of glory of Khazad Dûm at its height. You know, we've seen this area before in the Fellowship of the Ring. The Mines of Moria is what came out of Khazad Dûm, and after it was abandoned and it was in darkness, and it was quite a scary, spooky kind of section of those films. But here we just get to see this rich civilization. It's alive and well. There's waterfalls and elevators and there's greenery, you know, inside the mountain, and it's just absolutely gorgeous. So I wanted to give just a little bit of background about dwarves, since this is the first time that we're going to be seeing them in this season. So a little bit of information from the history of Middle-earth. Dwarves are considered to be children for about the first 30 years of their lives. And for about 10 years, from 30 to 40, dwarves go through a period of young adulthood or adolescence. So that's, I guess, their sort of teenage years between 30 and 40. And at 40, they're considered to be fully adult, and they'll go on more or less unchanged for about another 200 years on average, to the age of about 240. And then they sort of go into their elderly phase. They get white-haired and they become a bit feeble. That only lasts about 10 years, and then they die at around the age of 250. So much longer life than humans, but obviously, you know, only a blink of an eye in terms of elven years, who live for thousands and thousands of years. All dwarves are tough and they're really resistant to disease, so it's quite rare for them to die early except through violence. And the only physical dysfunction that they're liable to suffer from is obesity. And we saw quite a few of those dwarves looking quite portly in all of those scenes.
Yeah.
The Durin that we see here is the fourth Durin of his name. So there were six Durins spanning right through from the first age through to the third. And the first Durin was said to be the very first dwarf ever to awaken. And he lived far longer than is normal for his kind. He did die during the first age. But he was actually referred to later as Durin the Deathless. Dwarves do believe that reincarnation is possible. And they called him Durin the Deathless because they believe he was reborn to a descendant of his line five times. According to Dwarven legend, the reborn Durin could remember his previous lives, and so he ruled with the greatest wisdom. And the histories say that the elves aren't quite sure if that's actually true or just the dwarves telling a story, but it makes a pretty good story. I like it.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and then it was the sixth of his name. You've probably heard the word if you've seen the Lord of the Rings movies or read the books. You'll know that it was the sixth Durin whose people delved too deep and awoke the Balrog, who slayed Durin the sixth, and the glory of Khazad Dûm passed. And it was his grandson that settled in Erebor and then became king under the mountains, who we see in the Hobbit books and movies. And I just really loved this banter between Elrond and Durin. The humour and, you know, the moment that he says, absolutely no staying for dinner. You know he's staying for dinner. That was really cool.
You know. Durin knows his wife.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And she's fantastic. Look, I'd seen pictures of her, but not really heard much else. I know that she's a character that's made up for the show. And we haven't really seen many dwarf women. And so around the time of the events in The Hobbit, there was a dwarf princess named Dees. So I guess they've used that to make a fairly common dwarf woman name, Deesa. And the dwarf princess later that we see in The Hobbit, Dees, she was Thorin's sister, and she was the mother of Feli and Keli. So she wasn't actually mentioned in The Hobbit, but they did mention her in the appendices. And they say that only a third of dwarves were women, so the women were the minority. Dwarves only take one wife or husband in their lives, and they're jealous, as in all matters of their rights. Fewer than one third of the dwarf men actually marry. For another, not all women take husbands, because some of them desire none, some desire one they can't get, and they'll have no other. So many of the men also choose not to marry because they're so engrossed in their crafts. So it does paint a picture that a happy union is fairly rare. And I think they really brought that across. Durin and Deesa have found each other and they've fallen in love. I thought their chemistry on screen was amazing. Deesa is awesome. I love her whole look, her character. I love her golden eyes. And you can really feel the warmth of their home. You know, we're used to thinking of dwarves as living in these cold, dark mountains. And you could really get the sense that they had this warmth and brightness to their home. I really wanted to see the faces of the dwarf kids, but we don't get to see them.
Yeah.
I love their Scottish
accents.
That scene
was cute, though. It was really cute.
I know, it was so cute.
The giant heads.
And you could tell it's a home filled with love. And yeah, it's I love the idea of her singing to the mountain. That was a really lovely sequence talking about resonating. And, you know, we get to hear all of this in their fantastic Scottish accents. We also learn that Durin has lovingly tended the sapling that Elrond had given to him from the great tree in Lindon. And Deesa says that some people called Durin a fool for trying to grow it in such a dark place. And then Elrond says to him, "Where there is love, it is never truly dark." And I thought that was beautiful, and it sort of summed up their whole relationship, which was fantastic.
Yeah, and then he goes on to say, how could the tree help but grow in a home such as this? And at that moment, Durin's face softens just a touch, and Elrond sees it, and that's when he stands up and is all like, "Oh, I've overstayed my welcome. I have to leave," because he knows he's finally won Durin over by fully appreciating the beautiful family that Durin has.
Exactly. He sort of hooks him in and then goes to leave to kind of make him stay, which I thought was really cool. I mean, you can't live thousands of years without knowing how to understand and work with people's emotions, I guess, and communication.
I think Elrond is also sort of a diplomat among the elves. He says to Celebrimbor, "You are a master of your craft. Allow me a few days to work mine." And his craft is clearly relationships. And he knew if he could get in the mountain and get in front of Durin, that he could mend their relationship or get to the bottom of it and solve it.
Exactly. He just needed time with him. And so that's why he evoked the ancient dwarven ritual, and also why he asked him to escort him out. So he just needed those few minutes to try and sort of get in, which was great. And obviously they have come to some kind of arrangement. We didn't get to see too much more beyond that about what his plans are. That's all going to come to pass, I'm sure. That's pretty much all I have to say about the dwarves, but I just really absolutely loved that whole sequence. It was fantastic.
I did too. I wrote down, Khazad-dûm is spectacular. The walkways that crisscross and the soaring high ceilings, I wanted to live there. I'm a little bit photophobic. I have very strong sensitivity to sunlight. So the idea of a whole world with like filtered light and indoor waterfalls and greenery really appeals to me. I think Deesa is going to be a real fan favorite. She's so charming, as you were saying, and very strong. Durin really reminded me of Tormund Giantsbane from Game of Thrones.
Oh, yes, thank you. I was like, who's he like? That's fantastic. Yeah, I love it.
And Elrond really reminded me of young Obi-Wan Kenobi, the Ewan McGregor portrayal of Obi-Wan Kenobi. He had that sort of bearing and that like slightly amused expression and the cape and everything. He was very Jedi Knight to me.
Yeah, he seems to sort of consider things carefully and plan his next move. And he seems to be the opposite of hasty, doesn't he? He just really takes his time with knowing what's the next best thing to do, which was really great to see. Yeah.
I enjoyed the contest a great deal. The dwarves as a whole, I wrote down gusto. They loved everything. They loved chanting. They loved stomping. They loved cheering. They loved that Durin won. They loved their beer and their food. And they are passionate and love their craft. And it's a fun group of people to spend time with. I felt very much kinship to them. Maybe it's my Scottish heritage. I don't know.
Could be. Fantastic. I love it. All right. So what's your next point, Penny?
Let's see. Oh, another theme. And this is another one that was also in the Lord of the Rings books and movies, is technology versus nature and the lure of industrialization and development of new technologies. Celebrimbor represents this. He's a master smith. He's made beautiful things, but he has this ambition. So when he and Elrond are talking, Elrond admires Fëanor's hammer and says, "Strange, isn't it, how one object could be responsible for creating so much beauty and so much pain?" And this is the theme, right? It's that you have to be judicious and wise about how you use your tools and your power so that you don't end in disaster. Caleb Brimborn is very ambitious. He says, true creation requires sacrifice, as if the pain caused by Feanor's hammer and the Silmarils, and I'm hoping you'll explain a little bit about the Silmarils, is just the cost of creation. He goes on to say, when Morgoth stole the Silmarils, he found them so beautiful that for weeks he could do nothing but stare into their depths. It was only after one of his tears fell upon the jewels and he was faced with the evil of his own reflection that the reverie was finally broken. Feanor's work nearly turned the heart of the great foe himself. What has mine ever accomplished? And when Elrond assures him that his work turns hearts, Caleb Brimborn says, I aspire to do far more. An age ago, our kind brought war to these shores. I want to fill them with beauty, to grow beyond petty works of jewelcraft and devise something of real power. He says the what is on the far horizon and that Elrond is there to help him achieve the how, which is this great tower and forge as hot as a dragon's tongue and as pure as starlight. I couldn't help but remember in The Two Towers how Saruman uses a forge to create orcs, his Uruk-hai orcs, and weapons for them. And how he literally destroys the forests around Isengard to fuel his forge, destroying nature with technology. And I know that Tolkien was very concerned about the rise of technology in the world at the time when he was writing those books. And he designed the hobbits to be sort of living in harmony with nature and not destroying it. And humans being ambitious to move forward and create new things. And of course, Sauron, the ultimate wizard, seeks power above all else. But it's not only evil people that seek power. Good people seek power. It's very seductive and it can corrupt even the strongest and most noble-minded people.
Yeah, I think this is a theme all the way through for Tolkien, and something that he felt very passionate about. He could see the creep of industrialization into his kind of idyllic landscape where he lived in England, and that was always a central theme for him. That comes out really strongly in the books, in all of the books, and then I'm really glad they're sort of addressing that in this show as well. And yeah, I think it's going to continue to be a theme throughout, which is going to be really interesting to see kind of how they do that. And, you know, this is a theme in our world that just becomes more and more prevalent every day. And you look at climate change and you look at all the things that are happening in our world with industrialization and with technology, and trying to find that balance in our own lives between you know, embracing nature and the old ways and technology as well, which, you know, has benefits, but of course has drawbacks too. So I am really keen to see how they end up exploring this in the rest of the show. And I did like that description as well about the creation of the Silmarils. And so just to give a bit of background about that, the Silmarils were gems. They were the most renowned of all the works of elves. They were made by Feanor, as he describes in this episode, and they were created from the light of the two trees. So, you know, those two trees that we were talking about, the trees of Valinor, we spoke about in an earlier episode. And then these jewels were stolen by Melkor. Remember Melkor, our original big bad? He stole them and he wore them in his iron crown. Which is really a little bit of a giant insult to the Valar, right?
Yeah.
And to the elves. And so Feanor was furious about this, justifiably, and that's when he named Melkor Morgoth, which means dark enemy of the world. So that's how he went from being Melkor to Morgoth, the enemy that they sort of talk about now. And there's a whole history of the Silmarils and what happens to them after that. You can read about that in the Silmarillion, which is, again, not going to be touched on, I think, in this. They can only mention things that are mentioned in Lord of the Rings and the appendices. They can't go too much into the other legends. But you know, I'm hoping that one day those rights will come to whoever has the capacity to make big shows, because I would love to see some of the other tales from the Silmarillion, such as Beren and Lúthien, which is one of the earliest elf-human pairings. And that's a beautiful story. If you ever get the chance to go and read the Silmarillion and you only want to read one section, that's quite a standalone kind of story within that legend, which is really interesting to hear about. So you never know, we might get some more touch on that. But I like how they just sort of, it really in this show illustrates the depth and history of the elves when they start talking about these things that have happened previously. So I really enjoyed that as well.
The line, "as hot as a dragon's tongue and as pure as starlight," reminded me of nuclear weapons and the Manhattan Project and the famous line, "I am become death, destroyer of worlds," and whether or not Celebrimbor is headed for a similar hubris is to be seen. Elrond's idea to help him build this tower is to recruit the dwarves, and that's how they end up going to visit Durin. One thing they don't explain is why Celebrimbor needs the tower finished by spring. That seems like a plot contrivance to me.
Yeah, I wondered about that. What's the rush? They live for thousands of years. You know, you would think that they don't have such a pressure of time for things. I wonder if they will go into that, or whether that was just their way of asking, you know, getting Elrond to think outside the square and recruit his dwarf buddies to come and help them with the tower. It could be. It might just be a line that doesn't really come up again, but we'll see what happens and why there's any urgency later on. And yeah, I think we will, we'll see what happens with Celebrimbor. I might touch on that in our sort of legendary spoilery section. But it was really good to see. And I really liked the character of Celebrimbor, how he was portrayed. He's obviously an artist. He's very passionate about what he does. He's passionate about other forms of art, and I thought the casting was great. I thought the actor was really good, and I am going to be interested to see what happens next with him and how that all comes to pass. It's going to be amazing.
He was very complimentary about the dwarves and excited to see inside Khazad Dûm and see their forge, because he said that they sculpt stone and that he admires all who can see into the mystery of things, who can divine from the plainness of what is to the beauty of what could be. And that really touched me as an artist myself. I admire that as well. Somebody else who can see something no one else sees. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I loved that as well. And I was actually a little bit gutted for him that he didn't get to go inside. He was sort of gagging to go inside and see. And then Elrond is like, "No, just leave it to me. It'll give me a couple of days." So hopefully he does get to visit Khazad Dûm.
That moment was so funny to me, because they just like walk up to the doors of Khazad Dûm as if they just were walking down the street from their house. And then Elrond goes in and Celebrimbor just like walks away. I'm like, do they have horses? Do they have a tent? Is there a camp? Like, where is he going?
Yeah, there's no backpacks visible. I noticed that too. Like the distance in terms of Middle Earth is not that far. You know, that it's pretty close to where they were, but still, it's like, come on, you've got to be sleeping somewhere or traveling somehow. But you know, elves have got good endurance. Maybe they just wander ethereally out of their woods and just keep wandering. Maybe eat a little bit of lembas bread or something. I don't know if that's been invented yet, but it was very conversational, their little chat and stroll, and then here we are, here's Khazad Dûm.
Celebrimbor refers to Morgoth as the great foe, which reminds me of how some people refer to Satan as the adversary. And it occurred to me that Morgoth is a similar figure. He's this legendary evil that existed from, you know, for all intents and purposes, the beginning of time. And he's a sort of a fallen angel as well. So he's the adversary. He's the foe. There are a lot of parallels to Christianity in Tolkien's work, but it's not direct. It's just sort of in the background.
Exactly. Yeah. And we talked about that in an earlier episode where you know, you've got the Valar, who are kind of more like the celestial beings, and then, you know, you've got the lesser beings from there, and that's exactly, Melkor was a fall. He was good, and then he fell. So it's really familiar imagery to a lot of people. You know, who are familiar with many different types of religions have that same sort of idea. So yeah, it's quite a strong image, isn't it?
Yeah. That's my point. And what's your next point?
All right. So that merges quite nicely with my next point, because it's the approach of evil. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about how they are setting the scene for things, you know, going sideways, which is basically just everything's scary. All these little images of evil things that are coming. You've got the sort of plague with the sick cow. You've got these burrowing orcs. There's a scene later with the stranger where the fireflies go out. You've got all this imagery around Halbrand talking about how his home is ashes because they've been attacked by orcs as well. And we see Bronwyn's home village destroyed. The tension was fantastic in this episode, where it was really built up with Arondir exploring the tunnels. I thought the pacing was really well done, and there was some real sort of thriller movie, horror movie tropes with him looking around and then feeling like he's safe and then suddenly being grabbed from behind. The shot of him after he comes out of the water was beautiful. I just love how these elves have a huge amount of expression to them. And, you know, he comes out of the water and he's instantly braced with his dagger. I couldn't see what happened to his bow. I don't know if he left it somewhere or he lost it. I was worried about that because the elves are attached to their bows and they're so beautiful. We might see that later on.
The lighting in that scene was exquisite, with the lanterns and earlier with the torches. It was a clever way to light the scene so that it looked realistic. I've seen lots of TV shows and movies where people are in tunnels or caves and it's inexplicably visible.
Yeah.
This was gorgeous, and it bathed his face in this lantern light while he was crawling. And so there was this mixture of beauty and terror that I personally enjoy. That's why I like the movie Midsommar, similar beauty and terror at the same time.
It was gorgeous, wasn't it? And I agree about the correct level of lighting. You do get some shows where there's just, where on earth is that huge light source coming from? And then you get other ones where it's the opposite, where it's so dark you can't see anything. You know, we're talking about caves and The Walking Dead. We're talking about certain battle scenes in the Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
It's really nice to be able to see what you're supposed to see on screen. And I thought that was beautifully done. The scene with Bronwyn returning home and she can't find Theo, and then she finds him in hiding. It's so tense. So she's about to go out and find help, and then she looks back at the cupboard and realizes, oh, I can't leave my son. I'm going to just hide. And she just hides in the nick of time. That orc was amazing. You know, we've seen them on screen lots of times, usually in large numbers, like a sort of a horde. But this was so kind of horror movie like, with the close-ups and the breathing and the jump scares, and they have this huge fight. She chops off his head, and then I absolutely loved it when she went into the villagers and said, if there are any of you here who want to live, we make for the Elven Tower at first light. No discussion. She just throws the head down, says what she has to say, and then she's out of there. And they're obviously all on board, because next morning off they go. And then they go to leave, and Theo takes his treasure with him. And oh my goodness, when that blood on his hand kind of ran up.
Oh, that was so creepy.
Oh, it was so creepy. It ran uphill, up his hand, towards the hilt of this thing. And on first watch, and I think it was just because it was on a smaller computer screen and the lighting wasn't as good, I couldn't tell as obviously that it was the hilt of something, but this is obviously, to my mind now, is the hilt of some kind of blade, and the blade isn't there. And then I could see in this scene, as the blood kind of fed the hilt of this thing, the blade started to kind of regenerate or start to grow, which was fascinating and really, really creepy. What did you think of that scene?
At first, I couldn't tell if it was regrowing itself. You know, it's these dark particles sort of swirl around it. And again, on the small screen, like you were saying, I was like, what's happening there? Like, is it rebuilding? Also, the mark of Sauron on the blade, like, flamed up. And, you know, it was very clear that this sword has some kind of you know, magical, mystical connection to Sauron. And I'm concerned that Theo's blood is going to make him somehow beholden to Sauron or attached to this blade in some dark way.
Yeah, he's really captivated by it, isn't he? He wants to keep it secret. We didn't see him stash it in his bag, but it's pretty clear that he's probably brought it with him. The way that he looked at it and the expression on his face definitely reminded me of all the times that we see in the Lord of the Rings series, anybody who's captivated by the ring or about to be sort of possessed by the ring, or when Frodo puts the ring on and he can see the great eye, that fiery sigil really reminded me of that as well. So yeah, that's quite horrifying. I like the character of Bronwyn. I like her son so far, and it's going to be really cool to see what they actually end up doing with that as well.
Yeah, Bronwyn is proving to be an early favorite among fans. I've seen a lot of chatter online that she's everyone's favorite. I find her really captivating, and one of the only human women who gets to speak, apparently. All the other women in the village are very old or wretched looking, and none of them have names or lines.
Yeah, and I think the first episode we got this feeling, this really beautiful feeling with her and Arendir. They have really great chemistry together, I thought, but she seemed sort of quite reactive. And then in this episode, we really get to see her take charge, and you kind of get a glimpse of what her character's going to be. So I'm really excited about that and to see where she goes.
She and Theo are very resourceful when they're fighting that orc. At one point, she throws some powder on the orc that blinds it or disables it a little bit. And then when Theo goes up in the hayloft or whatever and he gets the orc with the rope and then he jumps down to try to hang it, I was like, yeah, I was so excited. It was such a cool move.
Yeah, it was a cool move. And it also showed hopefully that some sort of foreshadowing that, you know, both he and Bronwyn are pretty strong. They're both quite inventive. And they're both, you know, I got that sense of a loyalty between the two of them, that they're protecting each other, protecting their way of life. And so it will be interesting to see if they do sort of use Theo as a bit of a device for that turning to evil, and if he's tempted, that will be interesting to see how that tests their relationship. But I thought it was set up so well in this episode that whatever happens later will definitely be a challenge to that.
I'm wondering, what do you think about the fact that in the destroyed village there were no bodies?
Yeah, I wondered about that too. Because it looks like a sizable village, maybe a few hundred people would have been there. And if it was just a sacking of a village, obviously you would have some fighting and you would have some deaths and certainly some injuries. But the fact that there were no bodies at all, that they were clearly taken away, potentially they were taken away as prisoners. I wouldn't see any reason for them to just take bodies if they had killed them all.
Unless they eat them.
Yeah, but that'd be carcasses. I mean, would you really clean up all the bones and stuff if you were going to be cannibalizing the whole town? I don't know. It was really creepy.
Yeah, I thought either slaves or prisoners. It's unusual that there would be no bodies, though, right? Like, somebody must have resisted, and it's hard to believe that the orcs didn't kill anyone during sacking the village, but they must have taken the bodies as well as any survivors. I mean, I assume it's orcs.
Yeah, and it depends. It could be a really coordinated attack where obviously they tunnel under everybody's houses, because we see that later in Bronwyn and Theo's house. So I wonder if it was a nighttime coordinated attack where they burst out and just grabbed them. And that's why they had the tunnels there, so they could easily get away with them.
Yeah.
Take them to where they're going. So yeah, I can't wait to see what happens with that. And I love these little wee snippets of mystery that we get all the way through that makes it more tantalizing to keep watching.
Yeah, it was really well edited too, cutting between Arendir in the tunnels and Bronwyn in her village and in her house, and the battle with the orc, and then Arendir being taken back into that like dark, viney hole with like many claws grabbed him. It wasn't just one orc behind him, it was several.
Yeah, yeah.
So creepy.
What's happening with him next? Oh, we get to see hopefully where they're going. You know, he's going to be a character that's going to last a little while. So obviously there's going to be something that happens. They've taken him somewhere, and I can't wait to see what that leads to. All right. So what's your next point?
Oh, that wasn't my point. That was your point. Okay. I'm a little lost. So my next point is about Nori, Poppy, and who I'm calling the Meteor Man. You know, he's fallen from the sky in this comet or meteor, and he doesn't seem to speak any language that Nori knows. She feels responsible for him. She wants to take care of him. She thinks she's meant to find him, which is an interesting twist. I mean, obviously, I think it's obvious that he's important. People don't fall from the sky every day. There's some lightness and fun as she and Poppy are speculating about what he might be. They keep calling him the giant because to them, he is. And Poppy says, what do giants eat? I hope not Harfoots. And then Nori says, just the ones that can't keep a secret, which I thought was quite delightful. And at one point, Poppy says he's not an elf. She says, wrong ears. And he's not handsome. I find Poppy generally quite charming. She's also a wonderful friend. She's very direct with Nori. She says, you know, what are you doing? She makes Nori explain herself. She counsels Nori, you know, you shouldn't maybe get involved with this guy in the future. If there's bad crops or whatever, people are going to blame us for it. Another major theme for Tolkien has always been the power of friendship. And I imagine Poppy and Nori will be together and supporting each other through their adventures.
Absolutely. And they remind me of our other wonderful Hobbit friends, Frodo and Sam. But in some ways, a little bit more maybe like Merry and Pippin. Frodo and Sam have sort of got more of a kind of master-servant relationship. It wasn't as obvious in the movies. I think they tried to steer away from that a little bit. But in the books, it's certainly more of a kind of slightly more unbalanced relationship in terms of a power sort of structure. Merry and Pippin are equals, and they're just, you know, cheeky friends who support each other and are loyal to each other. And I definitely got that as well. I think, you know, Poppy's counselling Nori and trying to get her to do the right thing, but she also is loyal to her. She covers for her, you know, when Nori's out there doing her thing with the stranger and Poppy's back in the village, she doesn't let on what's happening with Nori. So she is a really, really good friend. And yeah, she's got a delightful nature to her and some really funny lines, which I love as well.
Yeah, she's very charming. And I love the scene when they're stealing things from the village in order to help the stranger, and Sadak just misses seeing them. And he finally admits that the falling star is probably not a good omen, and he says they shouldn't break camp and run just yet. And there's something coming up. They say their migration is in a few days. I don't know what that is. It sounds like they are sort of like nomads and they travel around. Maybe they follow where the food is, or with the seasons, they, you know, go somewhere warmer or milder when it's winter. I'll be interested to see what that means and if we get to follow them.
Yeah, I got that too, and it sort of confirmed my thoughts on the kind of visual look and style of their village that we got from the first episode, that it did seem a little bit more temporary. You know, you see Hobbiton with these very well-established hobbit holes that are obviously permanent, built into the ground, beautiful carving, and they seem very settled. I got the impression from the first episode with the Harfoots that these villages are more temporary and could be moved. And so it was nice to have that confirmed in here that they actually do have a migration. No indication about how often that is. You know, is it every season? Is it that they just do it every few years, depending on what's happening in the area? But it sounded like it was a regular occurrence of some kind, and that they were all ready to move. So that was quite fascinating to see. And it's going to be really cool if we do get to see how they pack themselves up. I noticed that their houses, they're kind of like tunnel shaped. They look like little almost like little sort of tents, but I couldn't tell if they were sort of made out of just the materials that they find there or whether that entire thing would move. It looks like they could be almost like covered wagons. Like, I wonder whether they have, you know, we noticed carts, the carts that they use to just carry stuff around the village were beautifully made, but also the actual houses, I wonder if they have wheels and so that they just literally pick those up and kind of move, or whether they're just made out of local materials, like a kind of bivouac, that they get to this area, they grab trees and bark and bits of the forest and make these structures. So I'm sure that we're going to get to see that, and that's going to be beautiful to see on screen because they're obviously well practiced at doing this migration.
There was more beautiful cinematography here at night with the lanterns that we find out are powered by fireflies. It was a gorgeous light on Nori and Poppy's faces as they were carrying the lanterns, and it lit up just enough of the landscape to show us where they were. The scene with the fireflies and the stranger where he, you know, asks the fireflies or commands the fireflies to create this pattern in the sky was really beautiful. And Nori thinks it's a constellation, and I don't know why, but she thinks she knows where to look for that constellation.
That interested me too. I wonder, she seemed very certain, I know where we can look, so I don't know whether I had part of me wondered whether she was referring to Sadok's book, whether there's some indication in there about that, or whether she just knows whether she knows somewhere else or someone else who understands the stars. You know, he has talked about the omens in the sky and things, so potentially she could ask him, but I don't know. I kind of still get the feeling she doesn't want anyone else in the village to know about the stranger and that she's going to take this on herself with her wonderful friend Poppy.
Maybe she'll steal the book.
Yeah, maybe, and then just make off on their own. I'm glad she's got Poppy with her, whatever they do. I loved when the stranger was whispering to these fireflies and they were going into place, and Nori asked Poppy, what is he saying? And Poppy says, I don't speak firefly. I thought that was beautiful.
Poppy is probably going to be a real favorite of mine. I love her so far.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah, that sort of blends quite well into my next point. I haven't got an enormous amount to say on it right now because some of the things that I want to say are more speculation, and we'll leave that for our spoilery section. So just really what we're seeing on screen here with the stranger is that we don't find out a lot more. We do know that he doesn't speak, or he can't speak. It didn't even, apart from the what he was repeating back to Nori when she said, I'm Nori, and he said, I'm Nori. And apart from the whispers that he makes to the fireflies, he doesn't seem to speak any language at this point. He's trying to communicate with scratching out the shape of the constellation in the ground with the stick and then getting the fireflies to move into formation. He seems to have powers that are linked to his emotions. So when he gets surprised, or if he's, you know, at the start when he first woke up, there was this kind of it seems like he has a control or an effect on the wind and on the air around him. The trees bent into towards them, and this sort of wind and this kind of loud hurricane-like noise was happening around him. And he seems to be quite fatigued by his the use of that power, or the expression of that power as well. So there's a few little clues there, and I'll get a little bit into that later on. Was there anything else that you wanted to say about the stranger and the Harfoots?
Just that at one point, Nori says quick sticks, which I think means hurry up, or, you know, don't dawdle. I was wondering if that was another Kiwi phrase they threw in there.
I have heard it, but I can't remember if I've really heard it much in New Zealand, but my husband is South African and his family say it all the time, quick sticks. So it's definitely an expression that's out there. It might not be used a lot in the United States, but I definitely knew what they meant. And yeah, it's right up there with rattle your dags, isn't it?
Yeah, it was lovely, and I think I'm going to start using it.
Yeah, quick sticks. That's great.
What's your next point?
So I kind of went into mine with the stranger. Have you got your next one that you wanted to talk about?
My last point is about the end of the dwarf scene where Durin is talking to the king about his conversations with Elrond, and the king is very suspicious that Elrond either knows they have a secret or Elrond has a secret. He says to Durin at one point, you've always had sandstone in your granite where elves are concerned, which I take to be a weakness, right? Sandstone is a very soft substance, whereas granite is very hard. The king also says there can be no trust between hammer and stone. Eventually, one or the other must surely break. Durin wants to trust Elrond. He's clearly sort of fallen back in love with his friend. And then they go over to sort of this alcove in the room, and these hands come out of the darkness and open this small chest, and the chest is glowing, like something inside of it is special or magical. There's like light reflecting on the king and Durin's beards. And it reminded me of a convention that has been in many movies, and it's partially based on the legend of Pandora and her box, which had both good and evil in it. And she was told not to open it, and she did open it, and trouble ensued. But there's a movie from the 50s called Kiss Me Deadly that has a briefcase that glows when you open it. And it's in that movie, it's eventually revealed to be, sorry, spoiler alert for a 60-year-old movie. It's eventually revealed to be a bomb. And it's a movie about fear of nuclear power from the early 50s. This was later sort of referenced in the movie Repo Man. It's not a briefcase in that movie, but it's the trunk of the car. And there are lots of scenes where people open the trunk of the car and this very powerful light comes out of it. And sometimes it kills people. Same with the Ark of the Covenant in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And then, of course, one of the most well-known ones is Pulp Fiction. Marcellus Wallace's briefcase is this glowing, unknown quantity, and nobody really knows what it is. So this box, I imagine it's going to be revealed to us eventually what's in there, and it will be important to the plot. But for now...
Who's in the box?
What's in the box?
Yeah, so it's obviously this secret. And I think I'll talk a little bit about it in our spoiler section as well. But I really loved, like you say, this is a common theme that we see in a lot of TV shows and movies where the characters are on screen can see what's in this box or briefcase or any kind of vessel. It opens and you have this light shining on them, and you sometimes have the kind of angel music, it was certainly intriguing, absolutely. And I loved that kind of tension that's been built between the elves and dwarves again, where Durin and his father have this secret. They wonder if Elrond knows. They are speculating about whether that's why he came. And so obviously it's something that's very special in there. Did you have any thoughts on it?
I assume so. These are dwarves, right? And they mine for ore, so I'm assuming they've found some magical or powerful element or ore in their mountain, and it has properties that they want to utilize for more power. And it's kind of like the unobtainium in the Avatar movie, or what's it called? Vibranium, that is the meteor in Wakanda in the Marvel comics.
Yeah.
Oh, what's in the box?
That's fantastic. I absolutely love it and can't wait to see what happens next with that.
What's in the f-ing box?
I'd like to go into my final point and then we can move into a little bit of speculation. So the last point that I had, and I know you mentioned it a little bit, but I can see your thoughts on it from it not being one of your main points, was Galadriel's journey.
Yeah. I just thought this whole plot was meh.
And, you know, I got some Gendry vibes. I thought, okay, she's going to be rowing for this entire episode. So it's a little bit like Gendry from Game of Thrones when he's rowing and rowing and rowing. So she's obviously jumped off the elven ship in the previous episode. She's in the water. She's aiming to swim back towards Middle-earth, and then she meets this group of survivors from a shipwreck. She's taken onto their raft, and she meets Halbrand, and this is a non-canon character again, so made up for this series, which means that he could go absolutely anywhere. Got a little bit of a Alexander Skarsgård vibe off him, a little bit of a early Aragorn-type vibe. And yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where he goes. The sea monster attacks them, and Galadriel's left in the water again. Halbrand returns alone on this even smaller section of the raft, which made me think, made me not trust him very well. Was he really the only one that survived that entire attack? Or did he?
Oh, on third watch, I noticed he unties his section of raft from the bigger raft to make himself a smaller target and separate himself from the other survivors.
Abandoning them to the monster.
Throws them.
Yeah.
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 To save himself.
So it's a good way to already show that he is not really to be trusted. You know, he gets her onto the smaller raft and you know, basically says, where are we going? Creating a little bit of an alliance. But I do really like the tension between them. Yeah, they have this really... a lot of animosity between each other from just, you know, they've only just met. But again, going back to what you said about that tension between races, they don't think much of each other at all. He seems really suspicious of her. He says that he's from the Southlands and he was chased by orcs. He does rescue her when she gets dragged down into the ocean. He cuts her free with her dagger, but we don't actually see him return it yet. But underwater, you see him sort of startled to see it. I couldn't tell whether that was just because he thought, oh, great, I can use this to cut the ropes, or whether he was sort of a bit covetous of the dagger itself. She tells him to take her to the enemy's last location, and he says, I've got my own plans, Elf, which again makes me very suspicious of him. What part is he going to play? And then the storm passes, and they're exhausted, and they're finally found by a ship. And we don't know yet who it is. It's a shadowy figure on this ship. I have a little suspicion that I don't want to talk about, and it's only because I saw the rest of the series trailer and it tells you a whole bunch of stuff, but I don't really want to get into that now because I want to just wait and see what happens.
I had the exact same experience. I wish I had not seen the trailer after having watched the episode. I do think it's interesting that Halbrand seems also a little drawn to her or impressed by her. He, you know, she's clearly been like swimming. He thinks, you know, she's strong and determined. And I think he thinks saving her, first, it's like an instinct, right? You just jump in and save someone, but also that his chances are better with her because she is very strong and he can see that about her. Somebody on the shipwreck mentions corsairs are, you know, in these waters, and apparently they skin people alive, which sounded pretty upsetting.
Yeah, we do see the corsairs in The Return of the King at the end of the movie when everybody's showing up to that final battle near Minas Tirith. And they're visually amazing to look at. They're pirates, basically. And there's Peter Jackson did a cameo as the captain of the corsair ship. So they look like extremely rough and scary, and I could understand that that's what they do with people. So it definitely built the tension while they're sitting there waiting on the ship, on the shipwreck for whatever they can see coming out of the mist. They are scared, obviously, that it's going to be corsairs. But yeah, I don't think it's corsairs. The sails looked too white and pretty, so it remains to be seen who these guys are.
I got some Princess Bride vibes off of Galadriel swimming in the ocean, and there's a scene where Princess Buttercup jumps off the ship without a plan. She just escapes from her kidnappers, and then she's floating around in a nighttime ocean. And when Galadriel was looking up at the stars, I assumed to navigate with, it occurred to me how very much she looks like Princess Buttercup.
Yeah, and instead of the shrieking eels, we have this really big, scary worm or sea monster. Yeah, I don't know how necessary that is, except really as a piece of storytelling to move the story along to create the tension and the shipwreck and the danger between them. I think the focus really was on her meeting Halbrand and on what that's going to mean later.
Yeah, that was the only important part that came out of it. So,
all right. And so before we get into our spoiler section, did you have any notes that you wanted to talk about?
Just one. I wanted to talk about the opening credits. They show these particles moving of their own accord, apparently, and forming shapes and patterns. I thought some of the shapes might be elvish. And some seem to be just sort of decorative, like, you know, vaguely organic, like trees or something. But I couldn't tell if it was like sand or meant to be particles of light. And then at one point, these dark particles come in. I just didn't know what to make of it. It was very pretty, but I don't know what it means.
Yeah. No, neither did I. I think it was very stylistic, and I definitely noticed it as well. We didn't get that in the first episode. We only get these titles in the second, and it seems that's quite common with a lot of these big shows. They really just want to grab you with that cold open on the first episode, and then the second episode you get the titles. It was the same with The House of Dragon as well. So it's sort of a really in keeping with a lot of those recent shows. You know, Westworld had a really similar stylistic opening as well. I thought it was, I felt like it was gold. I couldn't tell at first whether it was sand or whether it was gold forming into these kind of shapes. I thought it was beautiful. And I did wonder whether it will be any different for each episode. You know, some big TV shows, they have a slightly different beginning depending on what's in that episode, because there was that section of the titles where you have this huge kind of pile of sand or grit or whatever it is, and then this kind of worm-like shape swimming through it. So I wondered if that was an indication of the sea serpent. So I'll be watching really closely next time to see if there's any difference in the titles between each episode.
Do you have any notes?
Yeah, I just had a couple more. I really noticed again the costumes this time around, and I think especially getting to see it on a bigger TV screen. The prosthetics and the wigs that they've used for the dwarfs are outstanding. I think they look amazing. They're really in that world, and they've really consolidated the look of those characters and those races. Some of the dwarves' beards were down to their feet, which I thought was fantastic, if not a little bit impractical, but I thought it was a really, really good look. And the other note I had was actually about Poppy and Nori. And when Nori is explaining to the stranger about how everything's going to be gone, they're going to migrate, and she wants to sort of help him before then. And she says this expression, she says, we're going to be migrating in a few more days and everything's gone, three rabbits to the moon. And that, I found that expression quite interesting. I'd never heard that before. I couldn't tell whether she meant whether that three rabbits to the moon is an indication of time, because that's when they have to leave, or whether she was saying everything's gone, three rabbits to the moon, meaning everything's gone sideways or haywire or gone wrong. I really couldn't tell from the expression of it. Did you pick up on that or get a clue from what she was saying?
I thought it was time, like 3 days until the moon tells us it's time to migrate. But your interpretation, or possible interpretation, that it means things have gone sideways also could fit. Hopefully it'll be clearer next week.
Yeah, it's tricky to know what they use for the indication that it's time to migrate, and whether that is seasonal and it's to do with the moon and the harvest and all that kind of thing, and how they measure time. But yeah, hopefully that comes up again, because I thought it was a really interesting expression.
I think they are very seasonal. Last episode, Marigold says to Poppy that the seasons give their lives a pattern, and that they live by the seasons.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And they live so close to the land, so they must travel around where there's food. I don't know, kind of like the American Native Americans did.
Yeah.
And I hope we get to learn more.
Yeah, well, let's just wait and see it all unfold. Fantastic. All right. So that takes us to our news section. Before that happens, we're going to take a little break. There's more to come, so stay with us. Thank you. Okay, so being the first screening of the first couple of episodes, there is so much out there online if you want to get into reading reviews, reading people's opinions, finding out everything that you can about the release of these shows. I've just got a couple of pieces of news here that I wanted to read. One is from The Guardian, and this one says, "The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, is likely to prove divisive, at least depending, not least depending on whether you watch it on a big TV or squint at its splendor on a phone or laptop. It's so rich and gorgeous, it's easy to spend the first episode simply gawping at the landscapes as it swoops and swishes between the lands of elves and dwarves, humans and halfwits. This is TV that is made for big screens, although surely destined to be watched on smaller ones. It is so cinematic and grand that it makes the House of the Dragon look as if it has been cobbled together on Minecraft."
Oh my goodness.
That's harsh to the House of the Dragon. I don't know if I agree with that, but I agree that it's grand. They go on to say, "This makes it difficult to judge The Rings of Power as an ordinary series because so much about it is extraordinary. It is Tolkien, which means this world is already venerated and beloved by so many, whether in the form of the books, Peter Jackson's films, or both. There is an extraordinary weight of expectation before any viewer presses play. Add to that the fact that it is reportedly the most expensive TV series ever made, $465 million for 8 episodes.
And it is staggering.
It's just another show." Yeah, it's an event, a spectacle, but if it isn't entirely perfect, does that make it a failure? So I thought that was just an interesting little snippet of opinion there about, you know, how perfect does it have to be, you know, from people. It was really interesting. And then from Hollywood Reporter, we have an article. And it says, "The massively expensive, heavily anticipated Lord of the Rings series premieres on Amazon's Prime Video late Thursday. Reviews have been mostly positive, while noting that critics only got to see 2 of the season's 8 episodes. Given the lasting imprint J.R.R. Tolkien's work has had on popular culture and the huge marketing campaign behind the show, it's a safe bet that The Rings of Power will gather a good-sized audience, both in the United States and worldwide, over the weekend. Answering the how big question, however, could take several weeks. It's likely that Amazon will send out a press release after the weekend touting the show's global reach and possibly about how it sparked additional demand for Prime Video. It's just as likely that any such release will contain little to no supporting data, percentage gains without a baseline of comparison, or touts about how widespread its popularity is with no actual audience figures. Amazon is hardly alone in this game. Streamers give out data for their programming on a need-to-know basis, and for the most part, they've decided that the press and the public don't need to know. But saying that, there will eventually be some data about the viewership. Nielsen includes Prime Video in its weekly streaming rankings, but those lag a show's premiere by 4 weeks, meaning that the Rings of Power numbers probably won't arrive until the season is 3/4 finished. Once those numbers do come in, there will at least be some benchmarks with which to compare the Rings of Power with other shows." So I thought that was quite interesting. I had expected, you know, like when a movie comes out, you know right away the first weekend, the opening sort of box office figures. And we've seen on some other shows that have aired on TV that you do get the viewer ratings immediately. So I thought that was quite interesting that we don't get to see that right away.
I've always wondered about the Netflix ratings. They famously don't release them because it sometimes seems like they cancel shows that I believe are popular. So I don't always understand their thinking, and knowing the ratings numbers would fill in a little bit of that mystery. But unless it's bad, I don't really care, because I think the show is beautiful and is going to be a big success. And I just want it to get renewed immediately.
Absolutely. And yeah, and it will. I mean, my indication was my impression of it was that it was definitely 5 seasons. And I think that it's not like they're going to have the first season and go, oh, that wasn't popular. you know, the article mentioned new subscriptions to Amazon. I know several people myself who never had Amazon and have signed up because of the Rings of Power. So yeah, it's definitely going to create some viewership for sure. So it will be interesting to see when we do get that information.
And speaking of viewership, some of our listeners have already viewed and sent us some great listener feedback. And we're just going to read some of these to you here. And I just want to let any listeners know, if you sent in feedback and we missed it, we're really sorry. Please bring it to our attention. There's several different places that we gather the feedback from, and it can be hard to make sure you got everything. Jody Langridge says, "I've just finished both eps and really enjoyed them. This is coming from someone who hasn't even seen any The Lord of the Rings movies. Fave character so far is Bronwyn. She is fierce, and I can't wait to see where she goes next. It almost feels like I am watching Shakespeare with some of the dialogue. A few jump scares along the way, and I might have some nightmares tonight, but I am sucked into this world now and looking forward to the ride.
Oh, that's great. Thanks, Jodie. And yeah, it is nice to hear from someone who hasn't seen any Lord of the Rings movies. In Jodie's message, she did a little surprise face emoji. But, you know, the expectation that people are going to be watching this film as giant fans of the whole franchise, yes, there will be some people like that. And there's going to be lots of people like Jodie who just wants to see this as a TV show. So I'm really glad that you're enjoying it. All right, so Derek O'Neill says, I'm only 20 minutes in and already enthralled. The music, the visuals are all beautiful. I can't wait to watch the rest of the first and second episode tonight.
Alma Contreras says, so far, I'm loving it. The Dwarf Mountain was epic, which is true. Definitely planning to rewatch so I can get better acquainted with characters and places. And who is this dude Nori found? Can't wait to listen to the cast. Thanks, Alma.
Thanks. That's great. Lindsay Schlick says, it was everything I wanted and more. Unbelievable scenery. Seriously, Anwen, can I move in with you? Sure, Lindsay. Amazing music, interesting characters, great storyline. I like how you can tell this is a time of peace versus darker times in the original movies. It was so nice to see all of the thriving elf kingdoms and even better to finally see what a dwarf kingdom looks like in its prime. Characters are strong. Cate Blanchett is my all-time favourite actress. This version of Galadriel is going to take some getting used to, but I do like her. Nori is a standout for me, although I'm not sure about this shooting star Jesus character. So far, he's a bit annoying. I haven't found my Aragorn yet, but perhaps Halbrand will be our series eye candy. Bronwyn was a badass with the orc, loving all these tough ladies. I just love these two episodes so much. I can't believe I get to live in a time where Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones are both new episodes at the same time. My nerd heart can't take it. So excited for the podcast.
Thank you so much, Lindsay. Our nerd hearts are also very full at this moment.
And our schedules.
Yeah, that's true. Brian White says, I've only watched Ep 1 and thought it was great. I'm not a diehard Tolkien fan, so I don't know all of the backstories and all of the characters. Well, you don't need to.
Yeah, you've got us to explain it to you, and hopefully we do a good job of separating that out into background and then using our Galadriel's mirror to explain some of the more spoilery sides of it. Jeff Allen says, I wish the Tolkien estate would give Amazon Studios the rights to adopt the Silmarillion because that would just be incredible. But what we got was still very good and I'm happy to have it. It's beautiful and I feel like everything I've seen fits well with Tolkien's legendarium, unlike the ridiculous Tauriel Killy storyline he's referring to from The Hobbit. Bear McCreary's score wasn't as good as Howard Shore's, but I consider that the greatest score of all time, so that's a pretty unfair comparison for me to make. It was still incredible, and you could tell McCreary had worked hard to pay tribute to Shore's work. I love that Amazon is releasing an album of the full score after each episode. It's like watching the episode all over again, but reduced to just colours and emotions.
That's some lovely poetry, Jeff. Thank you.
Beautiful.
We got two emails from Jason Kabasi, our podfather, the founder of the Podcastica Network. He says, Hi, Anwen and Penny. My God, this series is beautiful. I'm not sure I've ever seen a TV show as beautiful as this one. The gorgeous, lush landscapes, fireworks turning into butterflies, the various kingdoms and dwellings of dwarves, elves, and men, so intricately and gorgeously realized, the gold and silver trees of Valinor with their incredibly bright, glowing foliage. I mean, who needs shrooms when you have this show? And he has a little sticking your tongue out emoji. It's just so delicious to watch. Story-wise, I wasn't sure if I would be sucked in at first. I do think Galadriel is a compelling hero, and I think the actress is doing a fantastic job, but the whole thing feels a little more straightforward and maybe tame than I usually like. But by the end of the second episode, I was really drawn in, and now I can't wait to see more. The Lord of the Rings was always a story about darkness versus light and the struggle of resisting the urge to misuse power. I think they can do a lot with that in this series. I'm very much looking forward to guest co-hosting for the season finale. We are too, Jason. I've heard some are complaining about the show adding characters and other elements that Tolkien had no hand in creating. Anwen, I so loved the Tolkien quote that you read in the Rings of Power intro podcast, and I think it bears repeating. Tolkien said, "I would draw some of the great tales in fullness and leave many only placed in the scheme and sketched. The cycles should be linked to a majestic whole and yet leave scope for other minds and hands wielding paint and music and drama." It sure seems like Tolkien was open to other authors contributing to his story. Since The Rings of Power is mostly based on appendices to the Lord of the Rings books, it needs to be fleshed out with new characters and details. A few other random points. I kept hearing this series would be based on the Silmarillion, but I read that for some reason they actually don't have the rights to that story, and it's mostly based on the appendices from Lord of the Rings. I guess they can mention things from the Silmarillion if they're also referenced in the Lord of the Rings appendices or something like that. You might have already mentioned that in the intro, but I forget a lot of things. Long ago, when I read of the elves returning to the Undying Lands and Frodo going there at the end of Lord of the Rings, I thought it was a metaphor for heaven, or a heaven-like place. Here, as the elven boat approached it in episode 1, it very much seemed like that. I kept thinking, "Don't step into the light, Galadriel!" I felt kind of sorry for the poor snow troll from episode 1. These people trespass into its territory and then brutally murder it. Ouch! Maybe trolls are just psychotic and all need to be put down? Anyway, loved the first two episodes and I've enjoyed your coverage so far. Looking forward to more of both. The road goes ever on and on. Jason. P.S. I think because this is a story of darkness versus light, that's one reason why a lot of it seems to glow. The happy places glow with the light of love. The dark places are black and sticky.
Oh, thanks, Jason. That's amazing. And I fully agree. I think that that difference between the dark and light is even more accentuated in this series than we see later in Lord of the Rings. You know, we see in Lord of the Rings these happy, beautiful places, but also, you know, by the time we see the elven areas in Lord of the Rings, it's kind of the end, getting towards the end of their time on Middle-earth, so it has quite an autumnal feel. It's a little bit more muted in its colours. You have the beautiful kind of glowing green, happy feeling of the Shire. But in this series, I agree that it seems to be even more accentuated between the darkness and the light, and I think that theme's going to continue all the way through. And to your point on the Silmarillion, yeah, I did read that that they had to be very careful when writing the screenplay, and it was very carefully monitored by whoever's job that was to monitor it, that if they touched on anything that was in the Silmarillion but not mentioned in the appendices, and the main body of the books of The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, that they had to veer away from it. So, it is going to be interesting to see how they navigate that very delicate pathway.
We also got one voicemail from Steve Brown.
Hello, Rings of Power cast. What is it now? Yeah, that's what it is. This is Steve, and this is episode 1. Okay, are all these kids elves, or is it just the... Is that young Galadriel? That's what the subtitle said. These kids are a bunch of dicks throwing rocks at her boat. It's mean. This is young Elrond. Elrond. Hey, so Galadriel is still alive when we have the movies, right? The trilogy, The Hobbit, and the Lord of the Rings. But Elrond is not. Okay. Who's the guy in the movies and they left to go back to? I guess they left to go back to Valinor. I'm going to need explaining. Sauron, that's the guy who made the rings, right? Oh, no, that was a cool move when he put his spear or big sword down and she used it to leap up on top of the snow troll. Great. That was just a cold open. Oh, I hope I don't go too long. It's a big footprint for a dog. Wait, and who is this Elrond? What? I'm confused. Okay, so these tiny creatures are Harfoots? Ooh, that silent look from Galadriel, you can tell she does not like what the High King is doing, but she's going to accept it. Okay, so in this world, the elves rule over the men because this soldier is in this bar and this kid looks like he's a human. I don't know. I'm confused. Okay, I get it, Watchwarden. Men bad, elves good. Oh, she's backing up from the light. Now she's got to swim all the way back to Middle-earth. Now we got the man who fell to Middle-earth. Talk to you later.
Thanks, Steve. I didn't know if we were going to get a live Steve, and that was a live Steve for episode 1. I hope we get one for episode 2 as well.
Yeah, fantastic. I didn't know whether he might record them all together, but thanks so much for that, Steve. Yeah, you're right. So Galadriel, the same character as we see in the Lord of the Rings movies. And yes, Elrond is the same character as well. He is also many thousands of years old when we get to see him in Lord of the Rings. So this character here is portrayed by a different actor. In the Lord of the Rings movies, it's he's portrayed by Hugo Weaving, which is also a fantastic representation. So hopefully some of our explanations give you a little bit of background, Steve, into the history and who's who, because I can imagine if you haven't seen or heard most of that stuff, then it would be a little bit confusing. So thanks so much for your voicemail. I really appreciate it. All right. So this section, we're going to be discussing some bits and pieces of lore and legend and some speculations that we're going to make about what might happen based on that. And so if you just want to watch the show itself and you want to let it all wash over you and you don't want to have any ideas about what might happen next, you could skip this section. And we're going to be calling this section Galadriel's Mirror. If you remember in the Fellowship of the Ring, when Frodo meets Galadriel in Lothlorien and she asks him to look into the mirror, and that's where we're going to find out about some things that might come to pass. So here is Galadriel's Mirror.
Will you look into the mirror? What will I see? Even the wisest cannot tell, for the mirror shows many things. Things that were, things that are, and some things that have not yet come to pass.
All right, so there's a few things that I want to talk about here, and the first one is we had just discussed about what's in the box, and obviously something is magical in this box that the dwarves have discovered. At first I had thought it could be the Arkenstone. If you can remember, the Arkenstone is a jewel that the dwarves discovered, and we do see that featured quite a lot in the Hobbit movies, but it doesn't really fit with the timeline because it doesn't actually show up in the writings until the Third Age, when it's discovered by Thrain in the Lonely Mountain. So what I think is in the box, I think it's Mithril.
I think so too. And,
yeah, good. So it's not really written anywhere that I can find. I'm very happy to be corrected if someone wants to delve into the lore and call in and let us know. But from what I could find, it's not really known when the dwarves first found it. But it is extremely rare, and it's unique to Khazad Dûm. So after the dwarves abandoned Moria to the Balrog, after the dwarves delved too deeply for the Mithril, there was no other source for it in Middle-earth, and so that's when it became extremely rare. And we do see some things made out of Mithril in the movies. So we see Frodo's Mithril shirt in Fellowship of the Ring, which protects him from being stabbed by the cave troll. We also see the guards of the Citadel at Minas Tirith. They have some Mithril on their helmets. And it's also possible to make an alloy out of it called Ithildin, which is also known as Star Moon, or it means Star Moon. And the Ithildin was often used to decorate gateways and portals. It was visible only by starlight or moonlight. And again, we saw that in the Fellowship of the Ring when they came to the west gate of Moria, and it bore some inlaid kind of Ithildin etchings and runes. It was only visible when the moon came out. And that's part of the movie, if you remember, where you could go into the door if you answered a riddle. And the riddle was speak friend and enter. And Frodo figured out that you just had to say the Elvish word for friend, and in they go. So that's what I think it is. I think it's their first discovery of Mithril. And I think that's what's going to move the story along in terms of what the elves want. Are they going to share it with the elves? What's that going to mean for the power play and the interaction between them?
And Mithril is valuable because it's strong and also very light, which is why it's great for armor. Is my memory
right.
correct?
And yeah. I've seen some comparisons. You know, there's obviously we don't have Mithril on planet Earth now. You know, those of you aware that Tolkien wrote his histories and all these stories based as a as an interpretation of early history of our planet. So Middle Earth is supposed to be Earth, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago. So some of the similarities that you see between our worlds, but we don't have anything like Mithril, but I have seen it compared to titanium a little bit in that sense, that it's extremely light, but also extremely strong for its weight. And I think it's even more so, and it's, I kind of get the feeling that it's got a slight magical property to it as well, though that's not really explored a huge amount.
Well, it's glowing, so something is coming off of it. What are the, in the Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings books, the elves have created swords that glow when orcs are near. What are those made out of?
I'm not actually sure. I feel like I should know. If someone knows, please let us know. I feel like they're linked in some way to the Mithril, but I'm really keen to find out if someone knows the background to those swords. Please write in or call and let us know, because again, that kind of magical element that's linked to good and evil, it's that real common theme. So that would be really good to know. Awesome. So the other thing that I wanted to talk about in this section was going a little bit into who the stranger could be. And I wanted to talk about it now rather than in the main section, because there might be people who just want to watch and just see what happens. But I did want to speculate a little bit. And so there's a lot of theories out there on the internet already. I knew as soon as these episodes had screened that people would be suddenly getting into this. So who is it? Who's the stranger? Lots of theories. I saw a couple of people thinking again that it could be a version of Sauron. I don't think it's that at all. I think he's going to be coming in a different guise. The legends say that Sauron shows up in a very fair form, with a fair face, and there's things that happen later on where he ends up falling in with the elves and kind of seducing them a little bit. And there's a whole storyline that's hopefully that they're going to explore with Celebrimbor. And as we're in the spoiler section, I can say a little bit more about what we had talked about last time, about what Celebrimbor's role is. And if you're familiar with the histories, you know that Celebrimbor is the one that makes the three rings, the three elven rings, in secret from Sauron. So I think we are going to see that whole storyline play out. But it just sort of brings me back around to say that I don't think that the stranger is Sauron. There's a lot of people saying it's Gandalf. Gandalf is sent to Middle Earth, but he doesn't really appear until 1,000 years into the Third Age, so it's a little bit early for that. There's a lot of things that point towards it being that it could be Gandalf or a Gandalf-like creature. So, you know, meeting the Harfoots first would explain Gandalf's later affinity with hobbits. He arrives in flames, and Gandalf is known to have an affinity with flames. He says later on, "I am the servant of the secret fire, wielder of the flame of Anor," meaning that he quite literally wields the fiery wrath of the sun. But it's far too early. It's 3,000 years too early to be Gandalf. I don't think that they would do it. I feel like I have enough trust in the showrunners to not introduce such a pivotal character so early in this story. I think they're going to be condensing a lot of the storylines from the Second Age, but I don't think they're going to bring a character in that didn't appear until 1,000 years into the Third Age. But in saying that, it could be another of the Istari or the Maia. So 1,000 years into that Third Age, the Istari or the wizards appeared in Middle-earth, and it was said that they came out of the Far West and they were messengers sent to contest the power of Sauron and to unite all of those who have the will to resist him. But they were forbidden to match his power with power or to seek to dominate elves or men by force or by fear. So they came in the shape of men, although they were never young and they aged only slowly and they had lots of powers, mental and physical powers. They revealed their true names to few, but they used such names as were given to them. So later on in the Lord of the Rings books, Gandalf says to Faramir, "Many of are my names in many countries, Mithrandir among the elves, Tharkun to the dwarves, Aloran I was in my youth in the west that is forgotten, in the south Incarnus, in the north Gandalf, and to the east I go not." So these Istari are spirits. They belong to the Maia. So if you remember, the Valar are more like gods or celestial beings, and the Maia are more like angels. So five of them in the story came to Middle-earth. You have Gandalf and Saruman, and from Lord of the Rings, you'll be familiar with them from the movies and from the books. And you have Radagast the Brown, who we saw in the Hobbit trilogy as well. But there were also two unnamed blue wizards. So Tolkien later named them in other writings, and Tolkien did write that these Istari, or these wizards, came to Middle-earth together in the Third Age. But he actually fitted the story to his own needs, because later in the Peoples of Middle-earth, the Istari are said to have arrived in the Second Age. So that actually fits around the year Second Age 1600, which is pretty close to where we're at the moment, around the time of the forging of the One Ring. So their mission was directed at weakening Sauron's forces in the eastern and southern parts of the Middle-earth, whereas the other Istari were focused on the west. So that does kind of work for the timeline, that this could be an Istari or a wizard sent to Middle-earth to help. And Tolkien did write about these Maia or Istari having to get used to their corporeal bodies, which means that if this is one of the two blue wizards, or just a completely new wizard character, that could work with what we're seeing on screen. It explains that the stranger's inability to speak, his memory loss, his powers, and his kind of getting fatigued from using his powers. We did talk last time a little bit about whether there was ever meteors mentioned in Middle-earth. You know, how are we going to portray seeing this wizard arrive to Middle-earth? There is a meteor mentioned in The Adventures of Tom Bombadil and a poem in The Fellowship of the Ring. And the one from the Tom Bombadil goes, "He twinkled his feet as he thought of the meat of pepper and punch galore, and he tripped unaware on his slanting stair, and like a meteor, a star in flight, ere Yule one night, flickering down he fell from his laddery path to a foaming bath in the windy Bay of Bell." So we know there are meteors in Middle-earth. We know that there's Istari that are sent, initially in the story, not sent until the Third Age, but there is in Tolkien's writing that a stranger, a messenger, a Maia, has arrived here in Middle-earth in the Second Age to assist with the battle.
It's fascinating. I hope it does turn out to be an Istari. It's a beautiful story. And the idea that a spirit made flesh would be so disoriented when he reaches the ground, and that he wouldn't even remember what food is until somebody gives him food and then he eats it, shell and all. And the way his power is so raw and uncontrolled, and he seems so confused, it all makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. And when I first saw it, and before I did this reading about the background, I was worried that it would be Gandalf. I just feel like that might throw off those last remnants of people who are watching and are very skeptical and don't want anything to stray at all from the official stories of Tolkien. You know, there's a lot of people out there that are like that, and that's fine. That's up to them. But it sits better with me that it is an earlier version. I don't want it to be Gandalf himself. I think that's just tweaking the timeline just too much. And it sort of doesn't match as well with the other things that we know about Gandalf later from the other history. So let's hope that we've just got this new character that's either a blue wizard or another wizard that isn't written about, but the timeline fits for them to be sent here as a messenger.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. And was there anything else that you wanted to talk about? Spoilerific?
No, it's just, you already brought it up. I was wondering if this forge that Celebrimbor wants to build is going to be used to create the Rings of Power.
Yes, I believe so. So the One Ring was created by Sauron, but the Three Rings were created by Celebrimbor in secret, and that's what I think he's doing. So, let's wait to see how that pans out.
That's wonderful.
All right, that's our show. Thanks for listening, everyone. If you want to write in or leave us a message, you can find all our contact information at podcastica.com. And we really, really love voicemail. So if you'd like to go over there, it's super easy. There's a little tab on the right that you can click to leave a voicemail. Or you can just record a voicemail directly into the Voice Memo app on your phone and then email that to us at talk@podcastica.com.
While you're there, be sure to check out some of our other shows. Right now, I'm enjoying the Walking Dead cast is back because there's this anthology show, Tales of the Walking Dead. And if you're a person who's never watched any Walking Dead shows and you're sort of overwhelmed by the idea of 12 years of content, the Tales of the Walking Dead show is an anthology, and each episode is a standalone. So it might be a nice introduction to that world if you've always been curious about it.
Yeah, I haven't got into that yet, but I am looking forward to it. And some of our other shows, of course, your podcast, Penny, covering She-Hulk. There's The House of the Dragon, which is really interesting to listen to at the moment. And it's, again, one of those shows. I haven't read the books. And so I am really, really appreciating Rima and Kristen's coverage of that because it gives me the background that I need to understand all these different peoples and races and names and things that we see there in The House of the Dragon.
We're also covering Sandman right now. And if you haven't seen it, it's absolutely gorgeous. Not quite as gorgeous as Rings of Power and very different. But if you're enjoying the visuals here, I think you'll enjoy the visuals there.
Absolutely. And so you can just find all of those at podcastgood.com. The next episode for this show is going to be on The Rings of Power Season 1, Episode 3. And I noticed that no name has been released at the time of our recording today. It looks like the episode names are just coming out with the episodes themselves.
I like the suspense.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
All right, everybody, that's our show.
Thanks for listening, everyone. And remember,
where there is love,
it is never truly dark. And scene.
Ha ha.